WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. From Florida to Georgia, Tennessee to the Carolinas, it's cleanup, recovery, or rescue mode, depending on the location after Hurricane Helene. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper says in his state, it's all of the above.
We are sending resources and coordinating closely with local governments, first responders, state and federal partners, and volunteer organizations to help those impacted by this tragic storm.
Across the southeast, at least 64 deaths and counting from Helene. In the race for the White House, Democrat Kamala Harris is campaigning in Las Vegas, and her opponent, former President Trump, is in Erie, Pennsylvania, telling the crowd Pennsylvania voters have turned decidedly red.
Now they're all Trump Republicans because they know that Trump is going to take them to the promised land. We will.
Democrats disagree, but admit winning the battleground state will be close. This is ABC News. In the race for an attack, or at least the search for attackers of the Star of David.
Police say the victim told them he was walking in Pittsburgh's Oakland neighborhood near the University of Pittsburgh early Friday when a group of about eight men saw his Star of David necklace and began to insult Israel. The victim said he argued back, and at least three of the men began punching and kicking him before a bystander intervened. Pittsburgh police say they're working with the FBI on the investigation. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Sad news for fans of the soap opera Days of Our Lives. Actor Drake Hogestyn, known for his role as John Black on the soap, has died following a battle with pancreatic cancer. His family releasing a statement thanking fans for all their years of support. He was 70 years old. I'm Derek Dennis, ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey, hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
I noticed when you buy toilets, they all have like these snazzy names. The Ambassador. Toilets do not do any kind of ambassadorship. This is for people who take huge dumps, this model.
The Ultimax.
The Ultimax. Why would you name a toilet that? Just a serial number is fine.
Every single toilet should be called the King's Throne. That's it.
Works. It's a lot easier.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Artificial intelligence is controversial, but Wisconsin Technical College students are learning with the help of AI. Educators say it will prepare them for the careers of the future. Mike Moan reports.
Layla Merrifield, president of the Wisconsin Technical Colleges system, says manufacturers are making it clear they want a workforce that has the know-how in working with and programming machinery fitted with AI. She says that's why the system is integrating it with coursework at regional campuses.
Here in Wisconsin, we really have a structural workforce shortage, and our demographics are telling us that that will continue. And what we're seeing, it's really upskilling the workforce.
Elected officials face pressure to adopt regulations that would ensure artificial intelligence is used safely. Merrifield says schools in Wisconsin prioritize teaching students how to use AI ethically and appropriately. An analysis from the Center for Security and Emerging Technology says community and technical colleges have the potential to grow and sustain the AI talent pool, but barriers like inconsistent government funding need to be addressed. Merrifield says Wisconsin's campuses are coming off modest general aid increases from the legislature. She says they'll be requesting more in the next budget cycle. They also have to balance tuition affordability.
We understand that our students often come from limited means. They have limited financial resources, and so we try to keep tuition as low as possible.
And whether it's AI curriculum or other courses, Merrifield suggests they need the right amount of support to stay nimble and retool programming based on workforce trends. Waukesha County Technical College is one of the schools offering a class where students learn about the foundations of AI. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Tons of sunshine for your Sunday with light east winds developing. Highs in the upper 70s to near 80. Tonight, quite cool. Clear skies, light winds out of the southeast. Lows will drop to the upper 40s to lower 50s. Sunny and breezy Monday. Right now, it's 76.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, James Vanderloo, the head of OEC Group, an expert in transatlantic trade and tariffs, will get all wonky with me. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, I am Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast about all things justice-related, lots of court focus as well this weekend, including what happened in a federal district court in Manhattan just late this past week after the return by a federal grand jury of this multi-count 57-page indictment, a talking indictment charging the sitting mayor of New York, Eric Adams is his name, with all kinds of charges involving corruption and, in particular, engagements with Turks and the Turkish government, selling his office, basically undermining the official trust placed in him by the voters of New York City. And so Eric Adams shows up in court, and this again is our process. He is advised of the charges against him, and he pleads not guilty, which is standard. That's fairly routine. The attorneys for Eric Adams along the way are accusing the prosecutors of some inappropriate leaks in this case, said in a statement that they had informed the mayor's lawyers of the charges just by email, suggesting that they should have been more directly in contact with them. Counsel for Mayor Adams accused the prosecutors of creating the spectacle of a bogus raid. That's a reference to the search warrant of Mayor Adams' house, Gracie Mansion, right before that hearing, and criticized the news conference as a dog and pony show. Well, what is it that the U.S. attorney said about all of this? What kinds of things is Eric Adams facing right now? Damian Williams, who is the United States attorney, again, nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. He is the chief federal law enforcement officer for the Southern District of New York, announced the charges in Lower Manhattan just this past week, along with the head of the FBI. Not at all unusual, a part of the routine to have the investigator and the prosecutor both there. The mayor said again and again that the defendant, Eric Williams, had crossed bright red lines. He said, "This investigation continues," which is also very interesting. He added, "promising to hold more people accountable." And pausing on that for just a moment, it's very clear that this investigation, again, going on for a number of years, is not done. And as we know, in the circle of officials, including educators and law enforcement and many others, we've seen lots of retirements and resignations and departures and people continuing in those positions. Lots of investigations of other people beyond the mayor that may or may not be involved, connected to this allegation, this series of allegations about his engagements with the Turks. Lots more coming from that, and likely six, maybe seven different separate sort of stovepipe investigations involving these other people. Lots of concerns about the legitimacy, the legality of things that officials there in the city of New York have been doing in recent years, now discovered, and now the subject of at least this grand jury indictment, a major indictment, first time that a sitting mayor is indicted by a grand jury. The head of the New York FBI office, again, this is not the director of the FBI, but the head of the New York field office said this. He said, "The charges send a powerful message that public service is a profound responsibility. The indictment of a sitting mayor, he said, is not just another headline. It is a stinging reminder that no one is above the law or beyond reproach. Once again, that common theme that permeates so much of our discussion today. No one is above the law. We do not have kings. We do not have regents in America. It serves as a sobering moment for all of us to place our trust in elected officials, alleging here plainly that that trust has been broken. We hasten, as always, to add that Mayor Adams is presumed innocent until proven guilty, if ever, by a prosecution that presents the evidence to a trial jury. That's what will be coming up sometime in the perhaps not immediate future, but down the road. That's the purpose for the hearing next week, to figure out when this case can be tried, what kinds of discovery will be produced to the defense, again, as a part of this fair process that goes forward. And Adams, of course, denying any allegations here. He said that the charges are based upon lies. He said, make no mistake, you elected me to lead this city and lead it, I will. Again, all of that in response to these allegations of soliciting are basically foreign donations for his 2021 mayoral campaign, taking luxury travel, doing other things as bribes. And the speaking indictment then says that as the quid pro quo here, that Eric Adams then provided the folks with whom he was engaged in this fraud with benefits that they were asking for him from. Federal prosecutors said that shortly before his election as mayor, he actually pressured fire department officials to approve a high-rise Turkish consulate. And let's talk about that in particular. This is a speaking indictment, and there is some very interesting information about the allegations here and also a lot of color around the edges about how this happened, sort of the atmosphere that surrounded his behavior with the Turks and with other people. Here's the account of these ignoring of the defects in a tower's fire safety system in his role as mayor. What happens is that in September of 21, again, according to the allegations, not yet charged, but a part of the trial in this case, there's a fellow named Reyhan Özgür. He was the Turkish consul general. He asked Adams to get fire department approval for a new high-rise Turkish consulate where in Midtown Manhattan. Okay. And that was despite the fact that that building apparently had serious fire safety defects, according to the department, according to the allegations in the indictment. Time was apparently of the essence, again, according to the speaking indictment here. Mr. Özgür, again, the Turkish consul general, wanted the consulate to open in time for what? For a visit by the president of Turkey at the time of the United Nations General Assembly meeting, with something that's going on right now. In addition, a different meeting, obviously, of the General Assembly there. And in a phone call, Mr. Özgür told a representative of the mayor's that it's now Adam's turn. He said it's his turn to help Turkey. And this representative related the message to Eric Adams, who responded, I know, he said. Adams did as instructed, according to the allegations of the complaint, and repeatedly messaged the fire commissioner, who was then trying to keep his job under the Adams administration. Fire department officials who oversaw these safety inspections, a part of a regular process by the fire department there in Manhattan, was told that he would lose his job if he did not facilitate the building's opening in a timely fashion in time for the Turkish president to be here, even though, once again, pushback on that, department employee deeming the building not safe to occupy. And the official in the end did what he was told. You are a true friend of Turkey, is what Özgür sent by way of a message to Adams after this happened on September 10th. And sure, on September 20th, about 10 days later, the president of Turkey shows up. And he's at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for that skyscraper there in Manhattan. He has gotten the benefit of all of these exchanges and monetary exchanges between the Turks and the mayor. That is one of many accounts in this speaking indictment. It is a compelling matter, not only for New York, but also for all of us. Once again, sending some messages here. And what are those messages? What do we take away from this? Even again, knowing that he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Well, once again, deterrence. It's that capital D word. Deterring him, stopping him from doing this in the future. We have eyes on you, is what the Department of Justice says, what the FBI says. We are watching you. We have been watching you. And now we've identified it for the world. Stop doing that. That's individual specific deterrence. And more broadly, It is once again this issue related to foreign governments involved in our politics and, most importantly, our government. Here, it's Turkey. It may be other nations as well. We don't know. Some of those other investigations may produce more information about this. This is not the end of the story, according to the United States attorney who announced this just this past week. But we do know that the message is clear. As to general deterrence, foreign nations, we're also watching you, and we can monitor what you do. We've got evidence. We've indicted this particular individual, and we've told you all about all the things that we know about your connections to him, your relationship with him, the ways in which you bribed him to get what you wanted, the false representations made in the public domain that tried to conceal this corruption. All of that set forth in this indictment. Members of the Turkish government, including the president, including others, we know what you're doing. Knock it off. Stop doing this. Do not become involved in this case in a municipal election, not just the presidential election involving those other matters we talked about involving Donald Trump and Russia and Iran, other entities out there. But in this case, a municipal election. And lo and behold, the FBI is on top of this as well. Perfectly investigating? Probably not. That's what the adversarial process is all about. That's what this case will expose and present in court over time, the strength of this case, but also those areas in which Eric Adams can raise legitimate defenses if he's got them. And he, again, is maintaining his innocence and saying along the way, taking a page from the playbook of another defendant. Yes, his name is Donald Trump, also facing federal charges in Washington, D.C. and in South Florida as well. What does Eric Adams, in addition to denying the offense conduct, what does he say? Well, he can deny the offense conduct. That's entirely appropriate. His attorneys likewise making clear that it is their position that they're going to defend against this and making it clear that from their perspective, this is going to result in a finding by a jury of not guilty, an acquittal of this. That is their right to say that, not only in court, but also out of court. What Eric Adams goes on to say, again, takes a page from Donald Trump. And he says that the reason why, even though he's identified, again, he called himself the Biden of Brooklyn, identified specifically as a Democrat in all this. He says, you know what? You know what? This is as a result of the Democrats going after me, Eric Adams says, because of my policies on immigration, the ways in which I'm dealing with illegal aliens in my city, because I'm being aggressive and doing these kinds of things, the federal administration, the Biden administration going after me, and this is a result of that. Sounds an awful lot like Donald Trump, again, pointing to a source where there's no there. There's no support at all. There's nothing that a president can do to accomplish this kind of thing. And yet Eric Adams now seizing upon what Donald Trump has said before in defense of his own position that indeed it's Joe Biden who is pursuing these prosecutions against him. And indeed, Donald Trump reaches out again by social media. We don't know if the two have talked at all, but he says, so I wish him luck. And by that, I is Donald Trump and him is Eric Adams. And he's not being sarcastic about that. He's saying, you know what? You are now in the same boat that I have been in for a long period of time. Now you are also receiving the political payback for being strong and being vigorous. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is grand jury process. These are people who are processing and prosecuting this case on behalf of the government in a non-political, apolitical way. It so happens to be that it happens to be a Democrat here showing the independence of the administration. When we come back, more about what's going on in the states of our nation having to do with the vote in November here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com. Your news just for the Superior area. I'm James Kelly with WBZH News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
The Second Amendment is designed to keep the power in this country with the people.
It's not the Second Amendment that preserves power in the people. It's elections, you moron. A dictator like Donald Trump that is a king and immune from prosecution, that is what erodes democracy. Kamala Harris and Uncle Tim Walz, they own guns. Nobody's coming for them. Chillax, Glenn. Get yourself some facts.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santella, and this is Amicus Law Review, talking about all things law-related, courts, lots of things related to courts on our weekend broadcast, and justice generally. In the wake of the indictments of those Iranians, again by a federal grand jury, and also of Eric Adams, also necessarily need to turn to what's going on again in the states of America. What are legislatures doing? What are Supreme Courts doing? What are other entities in the states of America doing that are going to affect and impact the November 5th election? Well, a couple of split decisions, if you will, split things coming out of Arizona and Georgia of just recent times. Let's begin with Arizona in particular, allowing 98,000 people, 98,000 to vote in state and local races despite a database glitch of the recent past. The Supreme Court in Arizona ruling recently that, again, nearly 100,000 people who officials could not verify were U.S. citizens because of an administrative glitch of the past, would indeed remain eligible to vote in the state and local elections in November. Their voting status, according to all the reporting coming out of Arizona, again presented to the Supreme Court for its decision-making, had been thrust into this sort of limbo when officials in Arizona, again, undeniably a battleground state along with Wisconsin and four or five others, about 4.1 million voters there in Arizona alone, and so 100,000 is not insignificant, discovered a problem there in Arizona with their data. The problem, as it was presented to the Supreme Court, appeared to affect voters who were issued driver's licenses before 1996. That's how old this is. Eight years before Arizona, the legislature there, had enacted a law, 2004, that law requiring voters to provide proof of citizenship to be able to participate in state elections. Now, if those license holders never voted or updated their registration information, their proof of citizenship might not be on file. And that's the key. And it would limit their participation to federal elections only. Again, these having to do with state and local elections there in Arizona. In a 9-page decision, the court's chief justice in Arizona, her name is Ann Timmer, wrote that it was plausible that the affected voters had in fact provided satisfactory evidence that they were U.S. citizens. We are unwilling, she said, on these facts to disenfranchise, good for her, unwilling to disenfranchise voters en masse from participating in state contests. That's the chief justice writing on behalf of the majority. Doing so is not authorized by state law and would violate principles of due process. All of that now entitling about 100,000 people in Arizona, previously the victims, if you will, with a small v, of this administrative glitch, prohibited previously from voting, now enabled to vote once again November 4th, again, the state and local elections. Why is that significant for all of us? Well, because, of course, whether people come in to vote for the federal offices, state offices, local offices, whatever prompts you to vote, gets you into the voting booths, right? And makes certain that you can vote. And if you have that capacity to vote in state and local elections, even though this would not have affected federal elections, you're there. The ballot, a unified ballot there, and brings people in and ensures that, again, 100,000 more people now in November can vote, who until the Supreme Court decision there could not do so. In Georgia, across the country, in the other direction, another direction by the Georgia State Election Board. We've spoken about them in the past, doing a number of things, plainly, according to many people, including the state authorities there, indicating that their behavior, their conduct is way outside of the assignments given to them. Among the things that they have done recently, voting to force counties, compel counties, get this, to hand count all ballots on election day. That's in addition to the regular processing electronically and other means. Hand count all ballots. And that's, of course, a move that many people on all sides of the political aisle are saying would delay the reporting results coming out of, once again, a key state, one of the swing states, Georgia, just like Arizona, Wisconsin, other places, would delay the reporting of those results in that battleground state, arguably, according to some people, injecting chaos into this post-election period. The new rule, which passed by a 3-2 vote. Again, this is an administrative group. This is not the legislature. It's not a court, although presumably a court's going to be reviewing this at some point. But this is the election board, runs counter to extensive legal advice from top election officials and law enforcement authorities throughout the state. A nonpartisan group of local election officials, not Republicans, not Democrats, have also objected strenuously to this change. The measure, as I indicated, is the latest in a number of things that the Georgia State Election Board has been doing to assert more jurisdiction and more power over things that it does not otherwise have power to review. Critics arguing that requiring hand counting in addition to a machine count would introduce errors and confusion in the process, potentially disrupt the custody of the ballots themselves, and poll workers would likely have to take a break opening the seals on boxes of completed ballots. That kind of a process would delay the entire system, exposing the ballots to fraud or loss. Previous elections, ballots remained sealed and stored securely unless there was a recount that was ordered. Thursday, the Attorney General's office in Georgia took a rare step in weighing in on these proposed rules, including this one, saying they are very likely exceed the board's statutory authority. Elizabeth Young, who is a senior assistant attorney general, characterized five specific proposals, including this one, as exceeding the board's legal reach, unnecessarily redundant, including, of course, this major hand counting process. Very troubling. There are no provisions in the state statutes, she said, in support of these proposed rules that permit counting the number of ballots by hand at the precinct level prior to delivery to the election superintendent for tabulation. She wrote that in a letter. She said, accordingly, these proposed rules are not tethered to any statute. There's no basis for doing them. And they're therefore likely to be precisely the type of impermissible legislation that agencies cannot do. The chair of the state election board, again, a bipartisan group, echoed that same concern, warning that members have done something that's going to undermine the process, slow it down, admittedly, but arguably even throw the results into some contest. The folks who are in support of this have nonetheless said that they voted in favor of this rule. They argued the board was creating more stability in our election process by bringing more transparency to the process, giving election officials the opportunity to ensure that the final results are accurate. Well, just the opposite. And others on the board said that it would create uniformity across the state, said it's not just fair to have some do it and some don't. That's from Janice Johnson, who's one of the members of the board. Interestingly, Donald Trump has called out by name some of these folks who voted in favor of this in his rallies. He called them pit bulls fighting for victory. And again, indicating the relationship between politics and partisan things and the elective process, the process which should be apolitical and nonpartisan. The board also approved an investigation in the 2020 election in Fulton County. Many other things that they're doing there, playing to the subject of review by courts as we go forward here in Georgia. The Georgia State Election Board, on its own, doing unstatutorily premised things, making decisions that are going to affect the ways in which votes are counted if, in fact, a court, a state court, a federal court, does not intervene and stop this from happening. All of that going on in Georgia. Even as, once again, in Arizona, across the country, we've got 100,000 more voters who are able to vote. And that's what it's all about. Voting Rights Act, 1965, 60-year anniversary of that coming up next year. We'll celebrate that. Voting is something that everyone should be able to do who is entitled to vote. And that's what this is all about. We'll continue with more of this on Amicus Law Review as we continue our discussion about things international going overseas. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matinee on Air.
ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. From Florida to Georgia, Tennessee to the Carolinas, it's cleanup, recovery, or rescue mode, depending on the location after Hurricane Helene. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper says in his state, it's all of the above.
We are sending resources and coordinating closely with local governments, first responders, state and federal partners, and volunteer organizations to help those impacted by this tragic storm.
Across the Southeast, at least 64 deaths and counting from Helene. In the race for the White House, Democrat Kamala Harris is campaigning in Las Vegas, and her opponent, former President Trump, is in Erie, Pennsylvania, telling the crowd Pennsylvania voters have turned decidedly red.
Now they're all Trump Republicans because they know that Trump is going to take them to the promised land. We will.
Democrats disagree, but admit winning the battleground state will be close. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Jordan Love returns. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. After missing 2 weeks with an MCL sprain, Love will take over at quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. Love said the Vikings will present a great challenge for the Packers offense.
You know, anytime you're holding the ball or sitting in the pocket, you know, those guys are really good on the other side, and they're going to find a way to get home. So it's always trying to get the ball out of my hands as quick as possible. And we'll do some good things protection-wise to be able to stop that. But at the end of the day, like I said, they're a good defense. They got really good rushers, and Flores does a really good job of sending a lot of pressures. It's an exotic defense, so you just got to be locked in.
Kickoff against the Minnesota Vikings is at noon. USC dominated Wisconsin football in the second half yesterday, putting up 28 points in the second half to stun the Badgers 38-21. Wisconsin has dropped two in a row and hosts Purdue on Saturday with an 11 a.m. kick. The Brewers, who are locked into the NL's third seed, defeated a potential playoff opponent, the New York Mets, with a 6-0 shutout Saturday. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cuska with Civic Media Sports.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Northern Wisconsin weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, clear skies, a low around 48. Breezy for Monday, a high near 78 with lots of sunshine and south winds up to 25 miles per hour. Winds still gust to 25 for Monday night, a low around 43. For Tuesday, sunny, breezy 59.
Currently 78 degrees.
Farmers in Wisconsin have always been ahead of the times, and it's no different in the mid-1800s. George Esterly was running a large wheat farm outside of Whitewater, but reaping his crop by hand was back-breaking work. Esterly invented a mechanical harvesting machine and used it in his own fields in 1844. He then won a Chicago Mechanics Gold Medal 4 years later. But was he the first in the country to build a harvesting machine? The answer is coming up. Esterly followed up his win by opening a factory in the Whitewater area, building the harvesting machines and eventually other farm equipment too. By the 1880s, 500 people worked there. So was Esterly the first in the country to build a new mechanical harvesting machine? Yes, this man's early farm invention lives on as a remarkable slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
It is National Monte Cristo Day. It's kind of one of those sandwiches. It's like bell bottoms. You just haven't heard about it in like 40 years. But it got me thinking, what's a sandwich that's totally overrated? I'm going to go first. The Philly cheesesteak.
Really?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm spoiled. Because in Wisconsin, we have the brat packed with tons more taste than a Philly cheesesteak.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Matinee on Air.
Dan Schaefer is here from the Recombobulation area and now Civic Media's new political editor.
Jane, I know you like to talk about our assembly speaker.
Popcorn King, yes, Robin Voss.
So there is a potential outcome with these new maps where Greta Neubauer is the assembly speaker and Robin Voss is the minority leader. How does that sound, Jane?
I feel like my birthday came early.
Matinee on Air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, very excited to have Lee McGowan, the politics girl, is going to join us as we break down the upcoming 2024 presidential election. Don't miss it.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. This, our second hour of our weekend broadcast, as always, inviting your listener comments, questions, and inquiries about the subject matters on our docket at 844-967-2789. You can also be in touch with Max and me by dropping us a line in the Civic Media app, texting us, being in touch with us, let us know what you think, and asking questions in particular. This is a lot. There's no doubt this is a lot. It's true every weekend in our broadcast, and certainly that applies to the next topic, which we're going to talk about in this segment and the next segment as well. And a bit of a warning here that we're going to be talking about rape. We're talking about sexual assault and the power and the response of law enforcement. We'll be talking lots about victims and the courage that at least one of them, many people, show in the wake of horrific sexual assault. And in particular, we're going overseas principally for this story. We're going to come back to America and talk a little bit about Sean Combs and Harvey Weinstein when we come back after discussing this matter in France. It has the entire French nation riveted because of the horrific nature of the allegations, what's going on in a court in Avignon. And we're going to talk about that because it is important to highlight not only the horrific nature of what happened here. It will shock you if you have not heard about this before. And even if you have heard about it before, the repetition of it becomes no less stunningly horrific. And we're also going to talk about the takeaways from this, the ascendancy, if you will, of a victim in this case who has become something of a national icon in France. She is the victim of the worst kind of crime possible. That is a violation not only of the trust from her own spouse, her own husband, but also sexual assault, brutal rape. And as I said in the introduction to our program this weekend, it is easy sometimes to talk about rape as a sexual event. It is not. It is power. It is violence. And it is the kind of thing that is intended to demean principally women, and certainly in this case. Let's talk about what's going on right now. This rape trial in France of, yes, 51 men. 51 men in France charged in their system with raping a woman. And we'll talk about her. We'll talk about the husband. And as a predicate to all of that, another civics piece, of course, as we always insert in these matters, and that is, I'm going to make reference to what's going on in the trial right now. It's going to have you scratching your head a bit because we're going to talk about defendants having already admitted to the offense conduct, some of them, not all of them. We're going to talk about a defendant who has also admitted to what he did, the terrible things that he did with respect to his wife over a long period of time. We'll talk about the presentations made by the victim herself. Lots of things going to indicate to you, even the ways in which the court is handling this, that this is a very different system. And indeed it is. Indeed it is, because of the way that the French authorities, the French legislature, has established mechanisms for addressing these kinds of crimes, recognizing once again that our system, which I've spent a huge amount of time talking about in connection not only with Donald Trump, but many others who find themselves in state and federal court here, our system, not common, not the one that's predominant on the face of the planet. Many others have a judge-centric system responsible for investigating the case. Yes, indeed, with investigators. And yes, there are prosecutors and defense counsel, but a very different system and different presumptions and assumptions along the way. And that's going to be reflected in the way in which I talk about what is happening right now in this trial in the southern city in France, Avignon. It has riveted, it has commanded the attention, stunned France, and would offer it should stun us as well. Dozens of men accused of raping a drugged woman. The man accused of masterminding the alleged abuse was her own husband. That fellow's name is Dominique Pellicot, P-E-L-I-C-O-T. He is accused of drugging her, his own spouse, raping her, and inviting the other men to join him. prosecutors in this case alleging and presenting evidence, compelling evidence, admissions that for almost a decade, for 10 years, Pellico drugged his wife. Her name is Giselle, G-I-S-E-L-E. She is 71 now. We'll talk more about her in just a few moments. To rape her and filming the abuse, filming this power violence. Pellico has pleaded guilty to all of the charges. Again, you might think, well, gee, why are we having a trial part of their system? And that includes aggravated rape and drugging. On September 17th, just this past week, Mr. Pellico testified for the first time during this trial. And again, presumptions of innocence, but again, he is pleading guilty. He said she, meaning his wife, Giselle, didn't deserve this. I recognize that, he said, as he's crying, as well he should. He later addressed his wife, who looked at him directly in the courtroom. She said, I regret what I did, and I ask for forgiveness, even if unforgivable. Giselle Pellico herself has said that she has no memory of the abuse, but that over the years she began to experience frightening, unexplained symptoms, not unusual in cases of sexual violence of this sort. Said she lost hair and weight, times incoherent, suffered memory blackouts, all kinds of other consequences of this sort of thing. The police investigated in 2020 and showed that there are three other women that Pellico also said he had abused, specifically filming up their skirts in a supermarket. And it was based upon that the police seized some electronic devices from his house, found thousands of videos, pictures of rapes and other abuse. This is horrific. And using those photographs and the videos, the police spent the next 2 years identifying and charging the subject. So what is this all about? Okay. Of the 51 defendants who are between the ages of 26 and 74 years old, 26 and 74 years old, including Pellico himself, charged with aggravated rape of Giselle Pellico. One is charged with sexually assaulting her, a lesser offense, and another with attempted rape. Pellico himself is additionally charged with drugging and accusing of taking recording, drugging and of the accused taking recording or transmissions of these events, sexual images of what's going on, including some of those of his daughter-in-law, and a former daughter-in-law. One of the men is not charged with abusing Giselle Pellico. Instead, he is accused of following the same model and drugging his own wife and raping her. Pellico is charged with raping the man's wife while she was drugged. It just goes on and on. It is horrific even to say out loud. The reason why this case is so different is because the way in which the prosecutors are alleging and have established already the breadth and the scope of this horrific sexual violence, the abuse is going on for years, the number of defendants, the variety of their ages, their professions, their backgrounds. And it has widened perceptions in France. It should widen them here in the United States and around the world about who commits sexual crimes. The authorities there have said that, you know, sexual offenders are often imagined as being dysfunctional misfits, when in reality, they are every man. That's what this trial reminds us of. In addition, under French rules, Ms. Pellico, the victim here, could have kept the trial and its sordid accusations, and they are lurid, could have kept them private. Instead, because she is who she is, she's come forward, she's decided to make it public in the hope that it would shed light on drug-facilitated assault of this kind. Stunning, stunning events going on there in France. Now, the trial itself is taking place before five professional judges. These are people who know what they're doing. There is no jury here. It follows a 2019 law, that entrusts to regional criminal courts the trials of crimes punishable by 15 or 20 years, and that includes rape or robbery. And to speed up these proceedings, which are going on right now, these courts use only magistrates and not juries, so that the judges can make the determinations, both in terms of evidence and other things that need to go on necessarily in these cases. The accused, every single one of them, all face up to 20 years in prison, maximum sentence for rape in France, unless the victim is tortured or killed, in which case, of course, the penalty is even greater. What has happened already in this case? The first day of the trial, devoted to addressing whether the trial would be open to the public. And that was important to Giselle Pellico. The judges ruled in favor of an open trial, and that's where we get all of this information. She decided that even in the wake of the horrors
that were visited upon her. She wanted the world to know not what just happened to her. That's a big part of this, not just to deter these individuals, these 50 or so, but also to let the rest of the world know that this kind of behavior will result, yes, indeed, in your criminal prosecution, brought to justice, and presumably sent to prison. Following days were spent reading the statement of facts, again, a part of a process that's not necessarily part of our system, explaining how the years-long investigation was conducted. Again, this judicial focus of the proceedings. On the fourth day, Gisele Pellicot herself testified. She told the court that over the 50 years of their relationship, she trusted her husband implicitly, she said, and had what she considered a normal sex life. She said, "I thought we were a strong couple. We had every reason to be happy," she testified about, again, in the public domain, because she said, "I want to be heard." She then recounted the point at which her life began to fall apart after all this happened. She said, one afternoon in 2020, when the police showed her these pictures of what they said was her husband abusing her, she said she contemplated suicide. She said, "I don't know how I survived." The next day, again, this continues, this icon, this woman of incredible strength there, goes on to testify more about what happened. And she is joined by her daughter, who goes by the pen name of Caroline Darien. She testified in saying that after being shown photos of herself asleep, that she did not remember being taken, she suspects her father likewise drugged her and possibly abused her too. And of course, Pellico himself denies that particular allegation. But along the way, her daughter says this: "What can you do for a person like me to heal? How do you rebuild from the ashes?" Stunning, stunning. And so all of this taking place again in France, turning Gisele Pellicot into an icon. I hesitate to say a hero, but an icon, a spokesperson, an incredibly empowered and empowering woman who has come forward to tell the world what has happened to her and to ensure that this to the extent we can, does not continue, not only in France, but around the nation. Many call her, as a part of her status, which is a product of her poise, her courage, turning her into this icon, not, as she says, a victim, but somebody who is moving beyond this. Many call her Gisele. And they do that, frankly, from a personal standpoint. They see themselves, many women do, and men support this as well in France. Their mothers, their grandmothers, they come to court in the southern city of Avignon and wait for hours to support her. "I don't know how she does it, her dignity," says one of the people outside of the courtroom. She says, "I admire this woman. She is exceptional." Yes, in the 3 weeks since the trial against her former husband and 50 other defendants began, Gisele has become a feminist, and I will say the word hero in France, because of what she has done. Her face has become a part of the understanding, the news reporting in France throughout the nation. The country is riveted by this. Activists of all kinds, feminists and men and all kinds of people out there, writers have penned open letters to her that have been published in newspapers, read on the radio. They laud her courage, her strength, her dignity in confronting this horrifying story. They praise her rare decision to fling open these doors, things she did not have to do under French law, and to bring into the homes and the businesses and the minds and hearts of all people these most intimate things, this, as she described, this intimate hell that she suffered, and insisting that the trial be made public, which could have stayed behind closed doors. And many victims out there, again, known, unknown, part of the process, not yet coming forward, many victims are saying in France and around the world that she speaks for them. A journalist and author wrote in the newspaper Le Monde, "It is not just you, Gisele, that they treated like a thing. They tell us all we are insignificant. Your strength brings us back, gives us back our strength. For you, we thank you for this immense gift." Again, all of this, a part of what's going on right now, riveting the people of France, should be riveting all of us for what's going on over there. Almost certainly all of them, again, in their system, going to be found guilty and brought again back into the halls of justice. She arrives each day, Gisele does, dressed impeccably, according to all reports, for battle. She's embodying this phrase that her lawyers coined at the beginning of the trial that has become a mantra among her supporters, that shame must change sides from the victim to the accused. As we continue here, we're going to talk a little bit more about these cases against these defendants, and including Gisele and other things that she has said and done to ensure that we understand what would happen there and attempt as best we can to ensure that this does not happen anywhere on the face of our planet as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
I don't know about other states, but in Wisconsin, we help our neighbors and love our communities. But California mega millionaire Eric Hovde doesn't seem to get that. Maybe that's why he questioned whether children should be able to stay on their parents' insurance until they're 26. And whether people in nursing homes should be able to vote. Hovde called for raising the retirement age for hardworking Wisconsinites and making obese people pay more for health care. And a Hovde company even spent decades trying to demolish the building housing Madison's oldest family-owned bar, something they finally did this year, shuttering a treasured neighborhood institution for good. That is not how we do things in Wisconsin. And that is why we can't let California mega millionaire Eric Hovde represent us.
Paid for by a Better Wisconsin Together Action. ABWT-action.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Waba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, talking about and doing some analysis also of the reason why this French trial right now in Avignon, the significance of it, even though the result is almost assuredly known. 51 people charged with these brutal, over many, many years, rapes of the victim, Giselle Pellicot, in that courtroom. As a result of her decision to come forward, not only as a witness, but also as someone who wanted her story told in France and around the world. Now, as a part of that process, of course, there are defense lawyers in the room, and they are doing their jobs. It is does have that adversarial aspect to it as well, trying to poke some holes in her credibility and in her self-portrayal of someone who enjoyed sex with her husband but was never interested in experimenting with other partners. This is very graphic stuff. And along the way, there are two series of pictures, 27 in total as a part of this trial. 20,000 photographs, videos the police found, among them 27 displayed on screens in this courtroom, prompting people to gasp as they looked at these very explicit pictures. Not going to describe for you in this broadcast exactly what they showed. But Ms. Pellicot, again, remained defiant. She said, addressing defense counsel, she said, "Is this an attempt to trap me? It's difficult to bear," she said. "What is it you're looking for here in this room? To make me look guilty?" She said, "If a man came to have intercourse with me, he should have asked for my consent." And once again, this notion, this takeaway as this trial proceeds, she also says, "I find it insulting." Again, commonly speaking the words of many other victims of sexual assault and this power violence. She says, "I understand why rape victims don't press charges." Indeed, that has been a part of our national history as well. And along the way, a lot of people saying that this is, again, the reversal of responsibility, trying to ensure that we have the defendants who are held responsible and the victims are identified as just that, as the survivors of this horrific event, as this trial continues there in Avignon. A message as well to all of us about not only the victims of sexual assault and these kinds of power violence crimes, but also the ways in which government, including prosecution offices and courts, are obliged to support those victims, provide them with the services well beyond the courtroom itself. What kinds of services do you need in terms of physical support, economic support, all kinds of things, physical, emotional, intellectual support? What can we do to ensure that the things that have been visited upon you are at least minimized in some marginal way, never, ever taken away completely? Can't do that. No court proceeding, no victim witness specialist unit's going to remove all of that. But the importance of addressing this, and again, the importance, recognizing it is a hugely dependent decision based upon the individual victim survivor, the importance of women coming forward. If they feel comfortable in doing that and identifying their accusers as Giselle
did, and bringing those folks into trial. Because once again, here's the word deterrence. Deterring those individuals who do that individually, that's specific deterrence, but sending the message, the general deterrence, to anyone else out there today, this weekend, in the week ahead, the weeks, the months, the years ahead, that if you try anything even close to this, even a singular rape, a singular sexual assault, again, not about sex, it's about power, it's about violence, it's about disruption of the human soul, the human condition, you will be brought into justice, and we will advise the world of what you've done and display it for everyone to see. Back in America, those lessons, those all-important lessons reverberate even just this past week. Harvey Weinstein, this disgraced Hollywood producer, we know him well. He pleaded not guilty to a new sex crime indictment in Manhattan court just this past week, months after a previous conviction was thrown out. This is the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, once again. Okay, it's Alvin Bragg's office, prosecuting Weinstein on the charge of sexually assaulting a woman in a Manhattan hotel in 2006, and also retrying the earlier case, not giving up. This is Alvin Bragg, the DA there, saying, you know, we may have gotten an unfavorable result first time around, but we're not giving up, and requiring, once again, victims and others to come forward and testify. The new charge of committing a criminal sexual act in the first degree is just, of course, the most recent legal trouble for Weinstein. He was and remains the center of these accusations that set up the global Me Too movement. He is 72. He's also significantly already been convicted on sex charges, and he faces prison time there. He is in custody, right? He had emergency heart surgery on September 8th. Prosecutors said in a hearing last week the new indictment would remain sealed until he was well enough to be returned into court. That day came, and that indictment again in the Manhattan court became public. Weinstein, again, convicted in New York of raping an aspiring actress in 2020. That happened 7 years earlier, but conviction happens in 2020. Also convicted of assaulting a former television production assistant who testified that he had forced oral sex on her in his Manhattan apartment in July of 2006. Immediately after all of this going on, the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, said he would prosecute Mr. Weinstein to the fullest extent of the law. Indeed, that's what he's doing. And he thanked the survivor who bravely came forward. Yes, indeed. We've got another survivor here who came forward and testified not only in the pretrial matters to produce the investigation that resulted in this latest charge, but also to come forward, presumably at trial, to testify in much the way that we're seeing in France, that same kind of thing, the same lessons. Different events, different circumstances, different people, different proceedings, different judicial system, but nonetheless underscoring those same all-important points about the responsibility of government and investigators and prosecutors to identify this nature of this crime, to bring it to justice and let us all know what happened and attempt to achieve some imperfect modicum of justice for the victims, survivors of it. Also in Manhattan, we know about Sean Combs. These are federal charges, all right? He was charged with running a criminal enterprise that once again included sex trafficking, a racketeering conspiracy. He is being held in federal jail. He is not released. And charged again with the sex trafficking, racketeering conspiracy, transportation to engage in prostitution in federal court one day after being arrested. He's pleaded not guilty to the charges. Again, both he and Weinstein, of course, presumed innocent until proven guilty. He will remain in custody as the trial is awaited. The magistrate judge denied his legal team's request for bail, citing his anger issues, his history of substance abuse, and a district judge upheld that decision. This is all going on in the federal court, saying that Combs posed a risk of witness tampering and a danger to the safety of the community, far beyond just the allegations, which are horrific, of this criminal enterprise that includes sex trafficking. A series of civil lawsuits also out there accused him of engaging in sexual assault, sexual misconduct, those also in the public view. All of that on a dark and difficult way to conclude our weekend event, our weekend discussion, but important.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, Dan Davies and Craig Kinnett talk about their giant spider invasion event, and
the lovable producer Connor will give a full report after watching in person the green and gold take on the purple people eaters.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Out here in the middle of these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. That's how it feels when you're struggling with your mental health. But you don't have to feel alone. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.